Today, reaping the whirlwind. Hello again, I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to the Property Imperative Weekly to the 8th of September 2018. Our digest of the latest finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. And by the way, if you value the content we produce, please do consider joining our Patreon program, where you can support our ability to continue to make great content. Here's the link, and it's also in the comments below. The big news this week was that after Westpac blinked last week, ANZ and then CBA both lifted their standard variable mortgage rates for existing borrowers by 16 and 15 basis points, or 0.16% and 0.15%, respectively. This was exactly as I had predicted. They both blamed the rising interbank funding rates, claimed that mortgage rates were still lower than 3 years ago, and that though it was regrettable, the impact would be minimal. Now let's be clear, existing borrowers are being caned, and while some may be able to shop around for a new loan at those attractive teaser rates, many cannot, so they are being milked. And there are more rises to come, in my opinion. And to put this in perspective, on a typical mortgage, this represents an extra $35 a month. But if you are sitting on a big Sydney or Melbourne mortgage, it could be much, much more. We discussed the shift in rates on our post this week, including more banks follow suit, and our discussions with people on the industry front line, including Sally Tyndall from Rate City and Mandeep Sodhi from Hashching. NAB, of course, has not followed the herd so far, so it'll be interesting to see whether they will. But the main point to make is this is just another burden on borrowing households at a time when, according to our surveys, households' finances remain under pressure.
The rate hike, ANZ denies, will create serious problems for home borrowers.
Today, credit losses in the banking system in Australia, not just for ANZ but for the system, haven't been as low as this in like 30 years.
To them, it's worth the risk.
But analyst Martin North says with a million households already under pressure, this is a slow-moving train wreck.
When you add the other things that households are facing, so things like childcare costs and electricity costs and fuel costs, it all adds a little extra weight in the saddlebag. On Tuesday, leaving the cash rate unchanged, the RBA said one continuing source of uncertainty is the outlook for household consumption. Household income has been growing slowly and debt levels are high. And last week they said the main risks to financial stability will most likely continue to relate to credit quality, notably banks' large exposures to a potential deterioration in housing loan performance is expected to remain a key issue. Our analysis of household finance confirms this, and the latest responsible lending determination, where Westpac agreed to pay a very small $35 million civil penalty, also highlight the issues. Their mortgage hikes will more than cover the penalty. So no surprise to see mortgage stress continuing to rise. Across Australia, more than 996,000 households are estimated now to be in mortgage stress, up 6,000 from last month. This equates to 30.5% of owner-occupied borrowing households. And in addition, more than 23,000 of these are in severe stress. We estimate that more than 59,000 households risk 30-day default in the next 12 months. We continue to see the impact of flat wages growth, rising living costs, and higher real mortgage rates. Bank losses are likely to rise a little ahead. You can watch our show, August 2018 Mortgage Stress Update, for more details. We also did a number of radio interviews on this. And have no doubt the credit crunch continues to intensify. The latest ABS lending data for July showed a fall in investor mortgages and a slowing of first-time buyers and owner-occupied lending. Apart from a small rise in construction finance, all indicators were down. We discussed this in our post, More Negative Lending Indicators. So now we see a reduction in borrowing power of households by as much as 40%. The number of refinanced applications being rejected, still running at 40%, so creating mortgage prisoners now that the banks are finally obeying the lending law. Plus, property investors now seeing capital being eroded. All this combined means lending will be compressed, and this in turn will drive home prices lower. The latest data shows that both home prices and auction clearance rates are still falling. And one other observation worth making, though hardly reported, the ABS released their June 2018 data relating to securitized loans in Australia. It showed that in the past year, residential mortgage securities rose by 8.9% to $108.8 billion. Overall securitized assets rose by 8.2%, which shows that mortgage assets grew stronger than system. This reflects what we've seen in the market with non-bank and some bank lenders using this funding channel. The rise of non-bank securitization is a significant element in the structure of the market. As major lenders throttle back their lending standards, higher risk loans are moving into the non-bank and securitized sectors. Of course, a decade ago, it was the securitized loans which took lenders down in the US and in Europe. The growth we're seeing here is, in our view, concerning, bearing in mind the more limited regulatory oversight. Plus, on the liability side of the balance sheet, around 90% of the securities are held by Australian investors, and that's a record. This includes a range of sophisticated investors, including super funds, wealth managers, banks, and high net worth individuals. The point to make that if home price falls continue, the risks in the securitized pools will grow, and this risk will be fed back into the investor pools. So this is yet another risk-laden feedback loop linked to the housing sector, and one which is not fully disclosed nor widely understood. The fact that the securitized pools are rated by the agencies, frankly, does not fill me with any great confidence either. Even the broader economic data, which showed that the Australian economy grew 0.9% in seasonally adjusted chain volume terms in the June quarter, really excites. Because it showed that new dwelling investments continue to prop up the numbers, along with government and domestic consumption. But the two key and concerning trends are a significant fall in the housing savings ratio as they dip into them to support their spending, and the slower GDP per capita growth, which shows that much of the GDP momentum is simply population related. This is based on trend data. Plus, real national disposable income per capita fell by 0.2% over the quarter, though it was up 2.1% over the year. Worse, the real average compensation per employee fell another 0.4% in the year to June 2018. And it's 4.2% lower than March 2012. No wonder households are struggling. And average remuneration per employee rose by only 1.7% in the year to June. So they remain underwater after adjusting for inflation, which is around 2.1%. Households remain under the gun. Economist John Adams and I discussed this in our show, A Disastrous Set of Results. Of course, GDP is really a poor set of measures by which to assess the economy in any case. One emerging question is the real risks in the bank's mortgage portfolios as home values fall and poor lending practices are revealed. UBS said this week in their latest Australian banking sector update, which involved an anonymous survey of 1,008 consumers, said that there was a sharp fall in the number of misstatements reported in mortgage applications over the fourth quarter of 2018. The survey revealed that 76% of respondents reported that the mortgage application were completed factually and accurate, up from 65% throughout the first three quarters of 2018. According to UBS, the improvement in lending standards was largely driven by the scrutiny placed on the industry by the Royal Commission into misconduct in the banking, superannuation and financial services industry and not off the back of regulatory intervention. Despite the improvement, UBS claimed that it's concerned about the 10% of respondents that reported that their broker-originated applications were partially factual and accurate, which it considers a low benchmark. Moreover, UBS stated that it continues to find that a substantial number of applicants state that their mortgage consultant suggested that they misrepresent on their mortgage applications. According to the figures of those who misstated their broker-originated loan applications, 40% said that their broker suggested that they misrepresent their application, which UBS claimed implies that 15% of all mortgages secured via the broker channel were factually inaccurate following the suggestion of their broker. This is concerning given the highlighted scrutiny on the industry, in particular following findings of broker misconduct and broker fraud in the Royal Commission, UBS added. There was an important video out this week, courtesy of the CEC, in which Denise Braley of the Banking and Finance Consumer Support Association, BFCSA, a real consumer champion, discussed mortgage fraud in the system. To cut to the chase, she says that many lenders deliberately built systems and processes to trick customers into loans that they should never have got. The central issue is the way that the loan application form, or LAF, was used. But she also touches on the cultural issues and fake statistics endemic in the system. You can watch the whole story. It's frankly disturbing. Add to the substantial liar loans issues the fact that home price values continue to fall and funding costs are rising, and we conclude the risks to the banking system are significant. Yet the regulators and bank auditors are not, in our view, doing their job. As more of this is exposed, expect bank share prices to slide further. The ASX 200 was down 0.27% on Friday to 6,144, having reacted to the latest GDP numbers and the bank mortgage repricing. CBA ended the week at 70.50, up 0.53%, but it was down on recent numbers. Westpac ended at 27.80, down 0.14%, and only slightly above the low of 27.30. ANZ was also lower at 28.40, down 0.46%. Expect more downside as the Royal Commission reports and as more mortgage-related issues emerge. The Aussie fell against the US dollar, down 1.29% to 71.05, a new low. And while the Aussie's descent was not as potent as last week, the pair breached under the December and May 2016 lows, below 71.45. Technically, it's now cleared to descend to the January 2016 lows at 68.27. Indeed, not only broken through 21.45, but it also fell under a descending range of support, which helped control its decline since May. However, the pair stopped just short of the 61.8% Fibonacci extension at 70.88, which might as well stand as immediate support going forward. The push-through range support also marked the pair's single largest decline in a day since August the 23rd, which was over 2 weeks ago. If the dominant downtrend in the Aussie once again resumes, a push under 70.88 exposes the 76.8% Fibonacci extension at 70.09. Meanwhile, near-term resistance is a combination of this December and May 2016 lows and the descending range. Pushing above 71.60 then opens the door to testing the 38.2% extension at 72, followed by the 23.6% level at 72.69. With that in mind, the descent through key support levels prolongs the bearish Aussie technical outlook. S&P Ratings said this week that the US economy and financial markets have been pulling away from the rest of the world. Of special importance is the lagging performance of emerging market economies, which not too long ago had been the primary driver of economic growth in the world. The combination of higher US interest rates and the relatively stronger performance of the US economy has triggered a notable and potentially destabilizing appreciation of the dollar versus a host of emerging market currencies. Excluding the collapse of Venezuela's currency, other noteworthy appreciations by the dollar since the year ended 2008 includes the dollar's 102% surge against Argentina's peso, the 74% advance in terms of Turkish lira, the 25% climb versus Brazil's real, the 24% ascent against South Africa's rand, the 15% increase versus India's rupee, the 10% climb in terms of Indonesia's rupiah, and the 11% increase vis-a-vis Pakistan's rupee. Emerging market countries have especially large current account deficits relative to GDP and are vulnerable to dollar exchange rate appreciation. The funding of large current account deficits require large amounts of foreign currency debt that is often denominated in US dollars. So as the dollar appreciates vis-a-vis emerging market currencies, it becomes costlier to service dollar-denominated debt in terms of emerging market currencies. And so to the US markets, where the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 0.31% to 25,917, while the S&P 500 ended at 2,871, down 0.22%. On the corporate news front, Tesla stock dropped 6.3% after Chief Accounting Officer Dave Morton resigned, as the level of public attention placed on the company prompted him to rethink his future. It ended at 263.24. Gripped by fear that the United States and China are heading further down the path towards a full-blown trade war, investors reined in their bets on riskier assets like stocks, pressurizing the broader averages. With this administration already expected to impose tariffs on $200 billion worth of goods from China, Trump upped the ante on trade, threatening levies on another $267 billion of goods. The levies on the list of goods could reportedly cover a wide range of products from popular tech companies, including Apple, according to Bloomberg. Apple later confirmed in a letter that the tariffs would affect the Apple Watch, AirPods, and Apple Pencil. It's difficult to see how tariffs that hurt US companies and US consumers will advance the government's objectives with respect to China's technology policies, Apple said in the letter. As a result, Apple fell 0.81% to $221.30 on the news, exerting further pressure on the beaten-up tech sector. The Nasdaq slid down 0.25% to 7,903, and Twitter continued its fall down 1.04% to 3049, as a number of the big social media tech stocks were hit after testaments to Congress on election interference and moderating content, including potential changes of censorship. There were also no new developments as Canada negotiated with the US about a revamp of NAFTA. The US employment report for August augured strong economic growth, but markets were spooked by an acceleration in wage inflation, which boosted expectations for the Fed Reserve to hike rates twice more this year. Beyond the creation of 201,000 jobs in August and a jobless rate holding near the 18-year lows at 3.9%, the focus was on the 2.9% increase in wage inflation, the fastest since April 2009. Although a quarter point rate hike was already fully priced in for the September 25th, 26th Fed meetings, odds of an additional increase in December rose to about 76%, compared to 70% ahead of the report. Energy, meanwhile, did little to stem losses in the broader market after ending the day roughly unchanged as oil prices were pressurized by a rising dollar and concerns about oil demand growth amid rising trade tensions. On the New York Mercantile Exchange, crude futures for October delivery settled at $67.84 a barrel, towards the top end of its price range. Gold was down 0.21% to $1,202, driven by strength of the US dollar, despite rumors of buying by a number of central banks, including China.
Short term, what are some factors that you're eyeing that can move the gold price, really move it, longer term?
I think in terms of longer term, it's the three sort of key catalysts. One, apart from the dollar, or the dollar itself, you know, has to kind of be lower or trade softer than it is right now. It's been a big headwind for gold. I think that inflation as well, we have to do a little bit better on the inflation side, particularly if there's an unexpected inflationary surprise. I think gold could benefit a lot from that. And then lastly, some kind of catalyst, be it geopolitical, be it a market dislocation. You know, we've had this stock market strength that we've seen now for a decade. And, you know, if we see a dislocation or a sell-off in stocks or in the bond market, you know, that
right.
can help gold.
Right, because we just don't have the volatility that's attracting
exactly.
investors. It's not moving, so they're thinking, well, how am I going to make money off of this, right?
Absolutely, and capital goes where capital is treated best. And right now, you know, with the strong equity market, it's just very difficult for people to make that kind of capital allocation yeah. decision to put money in gold unless you're a contrarian, unless you're diversifying portfolios, you know, in anticipation of something happening.
Bitcoin dropped on Friday, down 1.31% to 6,420, having plunged from 7,385 to 6,830, or 7.5% down on Wednesday, in reaction to a Business Insider report that Goldman Sachs had decided to drop a year-old decision to create a cryptocurrency trading desk. Apparently, Goldman is uncertain about the regulatory environment. Well, there should be no surprise there, I guess. Before I go, a couple of reminders. First is that next Sunday, the 16th of September, Nine's 60 Minutes program will be running a segment on the outlook for the property market. You may recall I was in Sydney a couple of weeks back for a recording. And a couple of days ago, they came back to get some additional material as the market is evolving so quickly. It'll be interesting to see how they tell the story. Next, we'll be launching our new series on the capital markets next week, where we will look at the concept of the time value of money, bonds, and derivatives. Given the size of these markets and the risks embedded within them, this will be an important series. And finally, our next live stream Q&A event is scheduled for Tuesday, the 18th of September, at 8 p.m. Sydney time. And you can set a reminder and also send me questions ahead of time. We will be looking in detail at the property market in this session. I look forward to your questions in the live chat. If you value the content we produce, please do consider joining our Patreon program, where you can support our ability to continue to make great content. The link is in the comments below. As always, if you like what you've heard today, please share and like the post and add a comment or question. And if you want to join the growing band of subscribers who receive alerts when we release new posts, do subscribe now. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Thanks for listening, and I'll talk to you again next time.